Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. Now, once in a while, a book comes along that utterly captures the imagination of the public. My guest today had never written a thriller before The Girl on a Train, which has sold over 20 million copies and generated a film adaptation that's filled cinemas worldwide. She's since gone on to write another work, Into the Water, equally as mesmerising. This is a huge achievement for anyone, but for a woman who came from Zimbabwe and started her professional career as a financial journalist, it's an amazing feat. Paula Hawkins, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you.
So let's start at home, our home, Zimbabwe. So you were born when the country was still Rhodesia, and of course that changed in 1980 with independence. Tell us a little bit about your family background there.
So my parents both lived there. My father was actually born in England, but was taken there as a baby. And my mother was born in South Africa and then moved when she was a child. So they've always lived there. My father's an academic and journalist, and he lives in Harare. And yeah, I had a quite normal kind of suburban childhood in Harare. There was a war on when I was small, but I felt very removed from it. I heard stories, but it was never something I had to confront personally. To me, it felt like an incredibly happy and normal childhood.
And you were pretty young when independence came.
Yes, I was just not yet eight. Yeah, 7 and a half, I guess, yeah.
So, I mean, you wouldn't really have been aware of any major changes pre and post-independence.
No, I can remember, for example, the first black child coming into my primary school class. When I started, it was all white. So that was an event. I mean, I was told about it, but yes, as you say, it doesn't really hit home. You don't have anything to compare it to. And it's only as I became a teenager that I became more aware of what the differences actually were.
Now, of course, education has always been absolutely first class in Zimbabwe. I know that you went to Arundel, an all-girls school. A lot of my friends went there and knew you and tell me that you were a very quiet girl.
I was. I was a shy, bookish, hardworking young person. That's what I was like. I was always quite driven. I think in those days I wanted to be a journalist, and I knew that you'd have to work hard to get anywhere. So I was always bookish, and I enjoyed the academic side of things. I test well.
What were you reading?
I was not a highbrow reader. I read a lot of trash as a kid. I mean, I read a lot of the things everyone reads, like Blyton and C.S. Lewis and those kind of things. As a teenager, I got more into nonfiction. I started to get a bit political, and I read lots of books about South Africa and in Zimbabwe and the situation. I always read a lot, but as I said, not particularly highbrow.
It's quite interesting, though, looking back at that literature of our childhood, in that as Zimbabweans, we were brought up still on Enid Blyton.
Oh, absolutely. It was completely bizarre because it had no relation to our everyday lives whatsoever. And I remember as a very small child coming to England when I was 4 or something, and my parents took me to Wimbledon Common, and I was just flabbergasted because I was like, oh, you mean as in the Wombles? It's real. You know, there's a real place. I had no idea that this was a real place. It is bizarre, but I think it's probably still the case that people around the world consume that kind of literature, don't they?
Yeah.
And the C.S. Lewis novels were sort of, I suppose, they were those fantasy books that everyone in my generation adored.
You left Zimbabwe when you were 17.
That's
and came here. And again, that kind of shock of I remember leaving at the same age and thinking, oh, look, daffodils, like they really were in the books.
Absolutely. It was, I'd been to London before. I'd visited as a tourist, but living in London was a big shock, having to commute on a train every day or on the tube into work, living in a huge city in which I didn't know anyone. It was a shock, and it took me a good long while to adjust to it, actually. I was deeply unhappy for at least a year or two.
Missing home?
Missing my friends. When you're 17, you know, I had a huge bunch of friends at home, and we were very, very close. So it was an enormous wrench to be taken away from all that. But then there were other ways in which I was very happy to come to England, to come to somewhere open, diverse, more tolerant, as I saw it, and with opportunities that I just wouldn't have had access to.
So you completed your education here?
Yeah, I finished my A-levels here, yes, and then went to university here.
And then got into journalism?
Yes, and then I became a journalist, which had been an ambition of mine for a long time, although I had ideas of myself becoming an intrepid foreign correspondent. And it turned out that I really didn't have the the temperament for that kind of thing. I'm too much of a coward and not bold enough. So I ended up, well, the first job I got was in financial journalism, and then I carried on from there, and I actually found it fascinating in many ways. It ended up a good thing.
Now, you've been billed, and obviously everybody knows you as the girl on the train author. Mm. In some circles, it's billed as your debut novel. Of course, it wasn't at all.
No, debut thriller is how it should be known. But I wrote four novels under a pseudonym before that. Amy Silver was my pseudonym. They were what people would call chick lit, so romantic comedy, very lighthearted. They were supposed to be very lighthearted. This was part of the problem, that I was commissioned, actually, to write the first one. I was asked by a publisher. They gave me a character and a basic plot outline, and they said, can you go away and do this in 8 weeks? So I did, and it did okay, and they asked for another one, and I wrote four books under that name. But I was not happy in the genre. I'm not a particularly romantic person, and I don't think I'm very funny, so romantic comedy was not my game, and I kept being tempted by tragedy. More and more terrible things kept happening to all the characters in my books, and, you know, the storylines just got darker and darker and darker, and it was very clear to me what direction I was pushing in, and it didn't work to try and do two things, so eventually I had to give that up. When the fourth one did terribly badly, so it was time to start something new.
So for most people, a book doing badly would not be the impetus to say, right, I'm going to give up everything, sit and write another book.
I think I was on the point of throwing in the towel and going back to journalism or trying to think of something else to do. I didn't particularly want to. And my agent, who's always been a great support and very encouraging to me, she was very keen for me to try writing a thriller because we talked about it before. I had ideas. I had half written something with this character who had a different name in those days, but she was a drunk who couldn't remember what she'd done last night. And my agent loved that character. She said, she kept saying, bring back the drunk girl. You've got to write about the drunk girl. So eventually I did bring back the drunk girl, and I put her on a train, and that's when she really came to life.
Mm. Now, that whole train thing, of course, you were commuting for years before that. Was that the genesis of the
plot? Well, I had done commutes. I hadn't done... My commutes were mostly in London, but I did sort of, I lived in South London for a long time and did sort of overground. There was a particular Wimbledon line that was terrible and it always had engineering works and it was always breaking down, and I would sit there and you were literally right outside people's houses. You were very close because it was apartments rather than terraces, and you could just see right into these people's homes. And I did spend a lot of time staring into these people's homes and really hoping that something interesting was going to happen, that, you know, you're going to see something. And of course, never saw a thing. I don't think I ever saw a person, in fact. But it was there, the idea that what would you do if you saw something shocking? And initially, my idea had been to write about somebody who witnesses an act of violence or something. And then eventually I changed that. So in fact, what the girl on the train witnesses is actually something completely innocuous. But to her, it has this meaning that she draws from it.
I wonder if you had any sense then of tapping into that zeitgeist, not only of the whole, I mean, there are so many themes there. There's domestic violence in this and indeed in your next book, also of binge drinking and the whole commuter culture.
Well, yeah, I mean, the binge drinking culture is something that I was very aware of. If you've worked in journalism for a long time in London, you know a lot of people who drink too much, who walk a very fine line, who function, but you could imagine without too much difficulty that if something went wrong in their lives, like the loss of a job or the breakup of a relationship, that they might really slide completely off the rails. And the commuting thing, it was interesting to me because I'd always loved this thing of watching those houses that you pass, but I hadn't really realized how universal that was until I started writing the book and talked to people about that impulse to sort of stare into people's houses. And everyone goes, oh yes, I do that all the time. And and in a way it's obvious, of course you do, because we all have that voyeuristic urge and we all like to people watch. So I didn't set out thinking, aha, I have all these elements that will resonate. I sort of lucked into it, I suppose, because the story I was telling had those elements in it.
I mean, the book did go absolutely stratospheric, and I wonder, I mean, you've talked about your agent having a lot of support from her, but if there was ever a sense early on that this was going to be huge.
I mean, my agent was excited, but your agent saying, you know, it's like your mum telling you you're pretty. She kind of has to say that it's good. When she put it out for auction and there was an immediate, very strong response from publishers, then I think I knew, oh, actually, this is going to be something. Until then, you don't allow yourself to believe that it's going to be. Lots of books have buzz. Lots of books have lots of chatter about them before they come out. and then they don't do as well as everyone hoped. And this one exceeded everyone's expectations tenfold, twentyfold. Nobody imagined it was going to do that well. So it was a shock to me, even though I was optimistic. It was a shock to everyone that it did quite as well as it did.
No, absolutely amazing. I mean, on various travels in different parts of the world, I remember right at the sort of peak of it, just seeing piles in every airport I went to, in every language imaginable. I mean, how did that feel for you?
It's strange and sort of at times overwhelming, and at times that you just feel completely disconnected from it, as though it has nothing to do with you. It was a wonderful experience, but it is quite overwhelming as well. It's very daunting to have something, to have your name suddenly everywhere and to have people talking about you in a certain way on social media or in the news or what have you. That is, for somebody who's shy and not used to the spotlight, it was not entirely comfortable.
Yeah. And do you engage with those discussions?
I'm not on Twitter anymore, but I was, and I really enjoyed it, and I like talking to readers and that kind of thing. But the more known you are, I think the more difficult it becomes. And I know that there are lots of people who are much bigger names than I am, like J.K. Rowling, who still managed to carry on with things like social media. But I found it was making me anxious, so I retreated, and I may go back.
Where do you think our hunger for thrillers come from? Is it because our lives are so kind of dull?
We all have a fascination with the darkest possible things that could happen to us. I think there's a certain element of exploring fears in a safe space, of wondering how you would react in certain extreme situations. There's just the joy of solving a puzzle as well, of trying to figure out who'd done it. We all enjoy that. Thriller plots tend to be quite neatly constructed, and that urge to just, you have to turn one more page. That's a wonderful thing. It's almost something that a lot of people don't have very often, that you have it in childhood, that losing yourself in a book. And then a lot of the time you disconnect from that. And for a lot of people, thrillers offer that completely absorbing read where you just can't bear to be dragged away from your book because you have to see what happens.
And is there a definite way to write? I mean, I've spoken to writers before who've said, you know, by page 12, this needs to have happened, a murder by page 75. You need to start seeing the solution by chapter 15, that kind of thing. Did you have that kind of structure in mind?
No, and I don't really write like that. Because I feel I'm more led by, definitely start with character, and I build around character, so I don't necessarily follow the conventions as you're supposed to. Obviously, The Girl on the Train was a more traditionally written thriller than the subsequent one, Into the Water. But I don't really obey the rules. I don't think it's actually necessary. I think there are some people who are devotees and who love the traditional structure, but there is so much you can do playing around with structure, and I actually really enjoy books that play around with structure.
Of course, it then went on to be made into a film starring Emily Blunt. How involved were you with that process?
I wasn't involved with the process at all, really. The book was optioned by DreamWorks before it was published, so they bought it on the basis of an advance copy, a proof. And lots of things get optioned. They don't necessarily get made. So I was never going to try and stick my oar in. All I could think about at that point was that I had another novel to write, and that's what I wanted my focus to be. So I spoke briefly to the director, Tate Taylor, and he told me his ideas, and I was quite, thought, oh yes, he thinks the same sort of things as I do about this. I immediately felt like I was in safe hands with him. I liked the producers. They were always like, oh, if there's anything you want to talk to us about, they were very generous with their time and what have you. So all I did really was the fun stuff. I went to the set and watched them film a bit, and I went to the premieres.
And does the film chime with your vision?
I think mostly it does. Obviously, the very notable difference is that it's set in the United States, not in London. And I know that there are a lot of readers who were very disappointed by that because they saw in their minds their commute. And I do understand that. Having said that, I don't think it didn't change the heart of the story, because one of the reasons that book worked well was because that story is universal and you could move it to lots of places and it would still work, because people do those kind of things all over the world. And it was very beautiful where they shot it. The people, the places, everything was more beautiful. And it was very dramatic from that sense. I thought Emily Blunt did a wonderful job of playing Rachel, who's not an easy character to portray. But she really completely encapsulated all that self-loathing. Her sort of shame radiated from her. I thought she was wonderful. So I was very happy with it. I had a very good, happy Hollywood experience, I have to say.
It would have been really easy then just to go and write The Girl on the Train 2, The Girl on the Boat, whatever. And you didn't.
Well, I don't know if it would have been easy, actually. I'm not really sure how I'd have done that. But I didn't want to. That was never in my mind. I had ideas in my head that I wanted to work on, and I had this idea about a pair of sisters who've had a terribly bad relationship, who've been estranged for many years, and their estrangement all hinges on a disputed childhood memory that they have. And that was sort of the genesis of Into the Water. And it's a very different book. I mean, there are themes that are common and there is an atmosphere, I think, that is probably similar. But it is a very different book.
So just sort of briefly to look at the book, it's in a small English town. It has a sinister history of drowned women. And as you say, these themes, memory is a big theme, and manipulated memory is sort of gaslighting.
In some senses, yeah, there is gaslighting, which happens in both books, but there is also the sense in which, as we retell stories, as we live our lives, as we try and form a coherent narrative for ourselves, we change the way we tell the past. And it's not that we may not even be conscious of doing this, but we change the way we remember things. So we actually remember things wrongly all the time. People do it all the time. And yet you can cling to things and really hold by those memories of your past and believe in them utterly. And what I was wondering about is what happens to you when later in life you are told that this thing you've been clinging to is actually not true at all, that you've misremembered or you've misconstrued it. And what does that do to your sense of self and the sense of the person you've become? Most of the time, I don't think it matters because most of the things we misremember are trivial and silly or what have you. But what if it was something that's absolutely fundamental to your being? And it's a very weird thing, the way we remember things and the way we can be absolutely sure that something happened in a certain way and then discover later in life that actually it didn't. Mm. It was just a story we told ourselves, or the way we related a story, or the way the story was related to us.
You write about motherhood in both books and the very complex relationship that we as women have with either being a mother or being a daughter, or indeed being a sister. There's a difficult relationship between Nell in the book with her daughter, Lena. The childless Jules is learning to be a mother. And of course, on Girl on a Train, Rachel isn't able to be a mother. And so all of these very strong emotions surrounding that come in.
It's a very emotionally fraught time for a lot of people when deciding whether to have children, wanting to have children or not, and not being able to, making other sorts of life decisions around having children, whether to work or not. And the thing that makes it way more difficult, I think, for women in particular, is that you don't make those decisions in a private way. You should do. But there's a whole public conversation that goes on around those decisions. And women are judged very harshly on decisions that are difficult and personal in a way that I don't think men are to the same degree. And that in itself, it has the unfortunate effect of making women defensive about their choices, which can then send them on the attack, because people are always saying, oh, well, women are the worst to each other. But that's kind of natural. If you constantly feel that your choices are being attacked, you try and defend yourself by going, oh, well, you know, at least I'm doing this right and she's not. And it's a very natural thing to try and defend yourself. And so it is a very fraught time. I mean, it should only be quite a short time, I suppose, from your mid-20s to mid-40s, but it seems all-consuming for a lot of women at that point.
Very much so. Water is something that, of course, is central, as the title would suggest. It's set in Beckford, which is not a real place, with this river running through it. And I wondered if you feel that you have some kind of intense relationship with water. Certainly, to me, reading the book, it felt so sinister. That river just sinuously wound its way around the dark recesses, felt.
Well, I think there is that duality in our relationship with water that most of us, I think, love being near water. And we have, again, it's caught up with childhood memories of going to the beach or to lakes, you know, happy memories of swimming in the sea or in a river or what have you. And yet there is always that sense of danger and not knowing what lies underneath. And the darkest, most horrible things can also happen there. So I think it's very fertile ground. It's also fertile ground for metaphor as well, isn't it? But it's very fertile ground for those sorts of stories, a thriller where people are drawn to something which is also can be very dangerous. And I think, again, it's something that most of us connect to. Most of us have some sort of relationship.
And, of course, as we were talking about, there's a certain amount of abuse that goes on in both books. And I wonder now, seeing this whole Me Too movement and the fact that we are talking now so much more about women who are being abused, if that had come up earlier, do you think it would have changed the way that you wrote your books?
I'm not sure. I don't necessarily think so. I mean, what I'm talking about in both books is mostly it's domestic violence of the sadly traditional sort that we've always seen. And I continue to go back to the statistic, which is that 2 women a week are killed in this country by a partner or an ex-partner. And it's something that just happens, and it's not getting worse, but it's not getting better either. Those statistics kind of seem to stay. So it's a very kind of normal thing that isn't really talked about that much, how many women are killed on a regular basis. What we're seeing now is a much wider conversation about just all the other ways in which women have to suffer things ranging from minor irritation to very serious assault in their working lives. I think that's what Me Too has mostly been about, is working lives. And, you know, obviously there have been all sorts of pushbacks against it. But I think, mostly, I think it has been a very good thing, just so that we can all sit there and take stock of just how common this is and just how every single woman you know has a story to tell. Mm. And loads of us haven't even told our stories yet, or have chosen not to tell our stories, but everyone has one. At least one.
I want to look at technique a little bit, because Into the Water is told from 11 different perspectives, and that's very unusual. Some are in the first and some are in the third person. And of course, many of them are unreliable too.
It was quite experimental and ambitious, Into the Water. I did play around with perspective a lot, which I enjoy doing. In terms of the unreliability, I'm of the view that any first-person narrative will necessarily be unreliable, because nobody tells the truth all the time. We all lie all the time, or we, as I said, misremember. I started with character, as I say, and then I had the story in my head, and this seemed to me to be the best way to tell the story. I'd created a community in which pretty much everyone was keeping a secret. And in order for the reader to be privy to those secrets, they needed to hear from lots of different voices. That seemed to me to be the best way of telling the story. And I know everyone agrees with me. I still think it was an interesting way of telling the story, and I think a lot of people did really engage with it. And I think I did the right thing by being ambitious and trying something new, because that's what I'm interested in doing.
No, absolutely. And just why would you not want to expand? With so many stories coming together, how do you manage that practically?
Not particularly efficiently, I don't think. I'm not somebody who has like a wonderful, a beautifully drawn chart or anything. It tends to be the case that I will write and rewrite and fit things together and chop things up and put them back together. And it is just something I have to try and keep as much in my head or on little scraps of paper or what have you. So there isn't a beautiful scheme in which I'm working. It's a much more chaotic process. But sort of I tend to know where I am. If I have to sort of explain to someone else, it becomes difficult. But I know where I am, and I know where everything should fit in. Mm-hmm. It just takes me a while to find the right pieces to go. Yeah. In the right places. So it's almost puzzle-like, I think, putting the thing together.
And in terms of research, I mean, obviously human emotion is available to us all, but things like police procedure and...
I know someone who used to be a detective who I asked questions of, and nowadays you can get a lot off the internet, but it always helps with things like procedure to actually know somebody to talk to, because the way things ought to be done and the way things are done are not necessarily always the same. I'm not a big researcher, and I'm also not somebody who obsesses about procedure. I think if you cut corners in a fictional sense about police procedure, that's absolutely fine, because if we wrote about police investigations the way they actually happen, they would be extraordinarily dull books. So I know some writers really pride themselves on getting every little thing right and still making it exciting, and good luck to them, but that's not something I'm just... procedure isn't the thing that gets me going.
Yeah.
Obviously, you don't want it to be ridiculous, even though there are things, television programmes, for example, that are obviously ludicrous, and yet people still love watching them.
And now, I know that there are a lot of people out there who like to think that they are at least striving to catch that little bit of Paula Hawkins' magic. How do you make a magic book like this? How do you grab the zeitgeist? Aside, of course, from actually getting on and writing a cracking great thriller. Is there anything that you think ignites
No, I honestly don't think you can go zeitgeist chasing. I think you're always going to be too late if you actually set out. People generally, whether they start with a character or a plot or a story, an idea in their heads, a concept, that's what you've got to stay faithful to and to build around. If it happens to be zeitgeisty, well, fantastic. But I really don't think that you can set out thinking, aha, if I do this, I will have a bestseller. Mm. Obviously, if you're writing about something that's hugely relevant, then that everybody's talking about now, then you might have a good chance. But you may also miss the boat by 6 months by the time your book's published. So I think you've just got to stay faithful to the story that you want to tell, because otherwise it is a hard thing to write a book. It takes a long time and it takes a lot of commitment. So if it's just something you're doing because you feel that hopefully it's going to make you rich, I don't think that's a great way to approach it.
Do you have a tried and tested routine?
Incredibly boringly, I just like to be at home. I work normal hours. Because I was a freelance journalist for a long time, I have very normal working practices sort of thing. I get up and I get on with it, and I don't go to cafes. I don't like to have noise or distractions. I sit at home at my desk and I write. It's incredibly dull now.
And what's next?
Well, I am writing at the moment in the same vein, I suppose, in the same, they call it psychological thriller sort of space. I'm not talking about it at the moment because I'm still too early on, but I have a book in mind, and that's what I'm going to be shutting myself away for the next however many months it takes to get that done.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that that is the, I mean, obviously it's difficult to rule out anything at this point, but is that going to be your career path? Are we talking about psychological thrillers, or do you see yourself going?
Well, I mean, that's the sort of space that I'm working in now, although I think the last book was less traditional psych thriller than Girl on the Train was. The books that I enjoy reading are not necessarily straight psychological thrillers, but there's almost always a crime at their heart and a mystery at their heart and some horrible tragedy that has to be unravelled. So those are the kind of things I'm examining. Whether it's a traditional kind of whodunity plot, no, not necessarily. But somewhere in that space, that's incredibly vague, but that's where I feel comfortable at the moment.
Well, of course, there's a lot of crime and a lot of trauma in Zimbabwe. Do you think you'll ever write about our home?
I would like to, I think, and I had an idea which I played around with for a while, but then set aside. I think it's quite difficult for me. I haven't lived there for a long time. I don't feel as in touch with things as I once did. I think there's also that thing of, because it's your home, it's incredibly close to your heart, and I'd be incredibly nervous about getting something wrong or pissing people off or something, which is ridiculous, but it would be a more emotional experience for me, I think.
Well, in the meantime, people can read your previous books, The Girl on the Train, and of course Into the Water, which is published by Riverbed. Paula Hawkins, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough and Christy Evans. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.